Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Welcome to the Daily Jungle. The Astros are your World Series champions. H-Town earned it. The better team won in a seven-game battle. And Brock Osweiler is your new starting quarterback in Denver. The Cleveland Browns are paying the Brock Lobster 900 gur a week to start for Denver. And we have three excellent guests, Hall of Famer Jim Kelly, Andy McCullough of the LA Times, and NHL great and thoroughbred racing legend Eddie Olczyk. It was so good to get caught up with Edzo. All of that and the Thursday edition of Alvy's Week That Was. Alvy, hit that button. Let's do this. H-Town, how are you feeling right now? I know you've heard it a million times since last night. You've probably said it to yourself a number of times. But the Houston Astros are World Series champions. How does that feel? How does that sound? The organization that lost 92 games in 2014 and more than 106 games each of the 3 years after is now measuring for rings. Those Astros were a mess. The Lastros look like a cosmic joke. Now they're the world champions. Not only did they turn it around, they turned it all the way around, and they did it quickly. Does that even feel real? Thing is, it should, because your team damn sure earned that title. That was not given to them. They absolutely ripped it. They went into Dodger Stadium, and they landed one haymaker after another early in the game, and then they just choked the Dodgers right out. And they did it in a Game 7. On the road in one of the most pressure-packed situations, and they didn't blink, and they didn't flinch. And it started early with George Springer in the top of the first.
1-1. And Springer rips it down the left field line, and that is a fair ball and headed into the left field corner. Springer on his way to second base as Peterson trying to come up with it, and it's a leadoff double for George Springer.
Astros radio. I've got to admit, every time that guy was up, I couldn't help but think something good is going to happen. Something good is going to happen to Houston and something bad is going to happen to LA. Every time that guy was up, first batter, first inning, and he was already causing damage. Then the Dodgers inflicted a little damage of their own with Alex Bregman at the plate.
Darvish, a look at second, now delivers. And Bregman bounces it right side. Bellinger to his right. He fields, throws to first, throws it away. Goes to the Astros dugout. Scoring is Springer. Bregman goes to second. 1-0 Astros.
Uh-oh. Terrible start. And it was about to get worse. Bregman steals third. Then he scores on Jose Altuve's sacrifice. Three batters into Game 7, and they were already up 2-0. And the thought was, there was no way they could hit Yu Darvish the way they did in Houston in Game 3. Yeah, that thought was wrong. They were sitting on everything from Darvish, either spitting on it or hitting it, and then Springer came up again in the second.
Here comes the 3-2, and George drills this one deep to left center field. You can kiss that one goodbye. A two-run home run for George Springer, and the Astros lead it 5-0. Springer homers for the fourth straight game.
Uh-oh. And Springer had just missed that pitch before. When I saw him just miss the pitch before, all I could think was, Darvish just got away with that one. He better make something of this. He really got away with that one. He missed the pitch before, but then he did not miss the one after. Absolutely smoked it. As he were to say later, he liked the way it sounded.
I just remember swinging and hearing the sound of the bat, and I knew it was a good sound.
Yeah, that wasn't a good sound. That was a great sound. A great sound for Springer and the Astros. The sound of a ball leaving the bat at 110 miles per hour. And that's why he was your World Series MVP. A record-tying 5 home runs in that series, a World Series record 4 straight games with a home run, and a World Series record for extra base hits with 8. His first 4 home runs either tied the game or gave Houston the lead. And all of that was after he went 0-for-4 with 4 Ks in Game 1. From the golden sombrero to the World Series MVP. And it may have been tempting to call ball game right after that bomb, but you could never call it that early in this series because no lead was ever safe. And it really wasn't in that game either because Astros pitcher Lance McCullers Jr. was pretty wild. He said after the game that he knew he didn't have much, which was accurate, but what he did have was HBPs in bulk, yo. Justin Turner, have one. Yasiel Puig, get some. Kike Hernandez, take that. Turner, have another. I'm not sure what's more insane. The McCullers managed to hit four guys in less than three innings, or that none of them managed to come around and score. And that was just part of the weirdness of last night. Like Brad Peacock batting in the fourth inning. Think about that. A relief pitcher batting in the fourth inning of Game 7 of the World Series. And that was all A.J. Hinch. Jungle legend A.J. Hinch. All him. And he showed last night why he's one of the best managers in all of baseball. Because that bullpen was a hot mess earlier in the series. And he handled it like a wizard last night. Four pitchers in the first five innings before he turned it over to Charlie Morton for the final four innings. Hinch and his pitchers took all the drama out of that game by being so comfortable in tough spots. One challenge after another from the Dodgers was met by an Astros team that was just too good and too tough. Can't say enough about how impressive that was from the Astros. On the road against a four-time All-Star pitcher, and they took care of their business. And they handled it like guys who had been there before, even though almost none of them had ever been there before. When you look at that team also, you have to think they'll be back again. They weren't built for one run. They were built for a long run. So credit to the Astros. Before we get to the Dodgers, credit the Astros. Before you want to take a run at any or all of the Dodgers, credit the Astros. Tip your hat to the Astros. Once you've done that, once you've acknowledged what they've done, then you can start blaming the Dodgers. Plenty of blame to go around, but only after you credit the Astros. They were so tough. They were so good. And they earned that. They deserve that. 1-800-636-8686. And I have lots of thoughts on the Dodgers. Things to think about that I want to get into right now, but just some things to think about. I always talk about how nothing ever lives up to the hype, and then I'll point out something that lived up to the hype. Yeah, well, last night didn't. Last night did not live up to the hype, because after one of the greatest World Series ever, we just got one of the crappiest Game 7s ever. And that's not to disrespect Houston. In fact, the Astros are the reason that game was so crappy, because they came out and they punched the Dodgers in the face, and then they choked them right out. So again, before you blame anybody on L.A., tip your hat to Houston. And then we can start blaming people on L.A. One thing I do want to get into, this whole notion that, well, they should have started Clayton Kershaw. No, they shouldn't have. And I feel really strongly about that. Easy to say now. You can argue that Dave Roberts should have gone out and gotten you Darvish sooner, but you can't argue that they should have started Clayton Kershaw. I mean, where were all you people before that game? I don't remember anybody saying before Game 7, gotta start Kershaw, gotta start Kershaw, gotta start the guy who had been hit around, who couldn't protect a four-run lead, who started 2 days earlier. Nobody said that, and nobody should have said that. So don't say it after the game when hindsight's always 20-20. Andy McCullough is my guest. You described last night's game as one of the worst games you've ever seen in a big atmosphere. The definition of anti-climax. Listen, before we unpack that, take me back to the start of the game, Andy. Last night, Soldier Boy is playing. Yasiel Puig is dancing in the outfield. What was the mood like at Dodger Stadium before that first pitch?
Yeah, I mean, it was a great vibe, you know. There was a ton of energy in the building. You know, it's difficult to get there by first pitch at Dodger Stadium a lot of times with the traffic and everything, but the crowd was, the stands were filled, tons of energy. You know, fans were really locked in, and the energy basically just disappeared right after the first at bat. You know, Yu Darvish gives off a leadoff double, and, they never got it back. I mean, Darvish just got crushed, and it was pretty brutal, you know, because this is a city that hasn't had a championship since, a Dodgers team that hasn't had a championship since 1988. And, you know, there was a lot of hype with this team. There was a lot of promise with this team. And to see it sort of end in this just really blah way, it just doesn't feel like the right ending to the story. You know, it feels like there should have been something more dramatic, something more interesting at the end.
Listen, these days, you can get practically everything on demand, such as our podcast. Listen whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. So let me ask you, why are you still going to the post office and dealing with their limited hours when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? Anything that you can do at the post office, you can now do right from your desk. As an example, the holidays are coming up. My wife, Janet, is all about the Christmas card. We send out hundreds, literally hundreds of Christmas cards, and there's no way we could do it without Stamps.com. I'm going to print my own postage. I'm going to do it when I want and do it at home. trust me, with the holidays coming up, you should do the exact same thing, and you'll thank me for it. Go to Stamps.com, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Jungle. That's Stamps.com, enter Jungle for a special, special offer. A four-week trial, which includes postage and a digital scale. Do not wait. You want to go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, hit the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Jungle. That's Stamps.com, enter Jungle. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office ever again. I know I won't. Stamps.com. Andy McCullough covers the Dodgers for the LA Times. So you mentioned Yu Darvish. Obviously, we're talking about a really talented pitcher who shut the Diamondbacks and the Cubs in the postseason, but then he couldn't get out of the second inning in either of his World Series starts. So the $100 million question, what happened to Yu Darvish?
If the Dodgers knew the answer, I don't think they'd be very upset this morning. I think they'd probably be celebrating a title because Darvish really, really killed them in the series. I mean, you know, to pitch two games and get 10 outs is just kind of unacceptable from a player of his caliber and his resume. And, you know, there's some whispers on whether or not he was tipping. You know, there's some question about how the slickness of the baseball, whether that was affecting his slider. But it was very clear, you know, that he was not confident in what he was trying to do. He wasn't sort of able to throw his slider, which has been, you know, his really money pitch since coming over here in 2012, and it's just a disaster. And I think the Dodgers really haven't had a ton of time to process what went wrong, other than just Darvish came up small. And I know that's sort of a cruel way to put it, but it's hard to figure it any other way. Because even if he's tipping, you know, just because you know what's coming doesn't mean you can hit it, and just because you know what the signs look for doesn't mean you believe them. So either the Astros were 100%, everyone was locked in and committed to seeing what the tipping signs were, or, you know, there was something else at play. I don't know. It just was a brutal, brutal showing.
Well, and as soon as he gets into trouble and then Clayton Kershaw comes into the game and throws four scoreless innings, the question inevitably comes up, why didn't Kershaw start the game? What's your reaction when you hear that? And is there any way that you could justify starting Kershaw in Game 7 on just 2 days rest, and especially after how things went for him in Game 5?
Yeah, I mean, my initial sort of reaction was just to kind of scoff at it because it's what you said. I mean, he's on 2 days rest, I mean, which is not a lot of days. You usually pitch on 4 days rest. And there's been, you know, plenty of studies shown that guys on 3 days rest are significantly compromised compared to how they are on normal rest. Kershaw's had that happen to him several times in the postseason in his career. You know, he's coming off 2 days rest. He got shelled his last time out. Darvish was rested, Darvish was ready, and, you know, I assume the thought would be, you know, as long as he's able to give you three innings, four innings, anything, they're in a really good spot because they have Kershaw and Alex Wood lined up behind him. But, you know, if the problem is you don't really have a backup plan when you have a guy come out and sort of pitch a catastrophe like that. Now, there's an argument, obviously, that, you know, Darvish shouldn't have been allowed to face here for a second time. You know, I agree with that. I think, you know, Brandon Morrow was hot at the time. He probably should have been in there facing Springer. But, you know, I understand why Dave Roberts wanted to stick with a starting pitcher. You know, he showed his faith in his guy, but his faith was not rewarded.
Andy McCullough joining us. I agree with you. I mean, no matter, you absolutely have to start him in that situation. But maybe, in hindsight, it's 2020. Maybe you don't let him face Springer again. And especially after he got away with that one pitch before he hit him about 500 feet.
Absolutely. Yeah, he hung a slider that should have been hit 600 feet.
Right.
The next one was only 500.
All right, now, Lance McCullers Jr., and he was pretty wild last night out of the gate, and he set a World Series record for hitting four batters. L.A., though, was unable to capitalize on that. Exactly what happened to the Dodger hitters last night, and in particular, the quality of their at-bats?
Yeah, it reminded me so much of just that stretch of baseball the Dodgers played in late August and September, when it just seemed like they could not sort of get anything going. You know, they couldn't get out of their own way. And the quality of the bats, you know, some of them were good. It was just like the sequencing was terrible. They would get guys on base, and then they'd have three, like, putrid at-bats behind it. And then the next time the guys who had the bad at-bats would come up, they'd have the good at-bats, and the guys behind them would have the bad at-bats. And so it was just, you know, a lot of guys obviously, you know, perform below what they usually do. I think Justin Turner batted 160. Yasiel Puig and Cody Bellinger were both batting, you know, 145. As a team, they hit like 200. So, you know, when you hit like that, when your stars perform like that, it's going to be tough to win the World Series, especially against, you know, a really, really good team in the Astros.
Right, so go back to Dave Roberts for a minute before you go. He took some heat for how he handled the bullpen in the series, but it's not just Roberts who's involved in that. The organization seems to have an overall strategy for how it handles pitchers, starters, and relievers. So what do you make of that approach, and is this something you think they might revisit and adjust in the offseason?
It's a great question, because if they get a little bit more from Darvish, if Kenley Jansen doesn't blow a save in game two, and if Clayton Kershaw, you know, makes seven runs of support hold up in game five, the Dodgers win the World Series. And we're talking about how what they're doing is sort of it's the revolutionary approach to how to handle a pitching staff. Every team should do this, you know. And I do think, you know, as we get further and further removed from this, I do think more teams are going to go to this model of, you know, being more aggressive with using their relievers. But in the moment, when it backfires like it did in game two, and when, you know, the sequencing is not as spotless like it was in game five, you know, that the criticism goes to the manager. You know, Dave Roberts talks a lot about how he sees himself as a proactive manager rather than reactive. He likes to anticipate the crisis before it arises rather than, trying to react once you see the crisis. And when that happens, you make moves that kind of cause fans to go, why is he taking him out? You know, Hill is rolling. He's only thrown four innings. But the argument is, if he leaves Hill in, something bad will happen. And, you know, that's based on data. That's based on, you know, probability. That's based on the matchups. It's based on a lot of different things. But it's not just based on gut intuition or, you know, him trying to meddle in the game. You know, they're doing what they feel is right to win. And it took them to Game 7 of the World Series. So I do think they might make some subtle tweaks to it. But this is how they're going to, run their pitchers going forward.
All right, so finally, what about Darvish? He said in the postgame presser that he would like to come back to the Dodgers. He talked about the debt that he feels he owes them. Could you see a scenario in which you, Darvish, is a Dodger next season?
I could, but it would involve him taking a lot less money, I think, than other teams are offering. I don't see the Dodgers as being interested in him in a nine-figure way, you know, one of those $100 million contracts. But, it'll be interesting to see, because if he does come back, you know, it's tough to imagine him receiving a welcome reception from Dodgers fans. I mean, this was a really, really rough performance. So I'm genuinely curious to see what happens, because, there will obviously a pretty strong market for him. And I wonder, you know, how interested the Dodgers will be, just given how this, you know, this series went.
We've already heard from Matt in L.A., so let's go to Long Beach. Ira is up early and in hour number one. He's been calling for several weeks now. I've got to get his thoughts. Ira, good morning.
Romy, I'm not up early. It was all nighter, my friend. But
my bad.
Gotta say, hey, Houston, great job. Enjoy your celebration. You'll have a year to enjoy it, and I have a funny feeling that we'll be seeing you guys again next October, hopefully. Now, Romy, we can get on to the real business at hand. And the party just continues. I'm glad to hear that you're taking tomorrow and Friday off, because the real fun is down where the surf meets the turf. Del Mar, buddy. You looking forward to this weekend? I sure am, because I think that the Breeders' Cup Classic is going to be just that, a classic. The deepest field I think I've ever seen in the 25-plus years. And I think that Gunrunner pretty much looks unbeatable at this point, even though he's never showed up on the West Coast. So ask Eddie O what he thinks. Have a great time at Del Mar, buddy, and be talking to you soon.
You got it, Ira. Thank you very much. And I appreciate you saying that I'm going to take tomorrow and Friday off.
I'm glad to hear that you're taking tomorrow and Friday off.
Matt in L.A. Matt, good morning. What's up?
Romy Rome, excellent morning as always here in L.A. A tip of the cap to Houston. Hey, you beat our ass. George Springer is a monster. I got to give it up. You know what? If I'm going to second guess anything, the only thing is maybe that Darvish shouldn't have got into the second inning. But like you say, Snaglito, you know what? It wasn't going to happen. I mean, nobody was asking for Kershaw yesterday, so don't ask for him today. I said the first arm should have been Alex Wood, but Kershaw did his job. Alex Wood did his job. The offense fell asleep at the worst possible time. And again, man, Houston grinded it out. They were the better team. War Stucknut, and all the Houston fans that are classy, Unwar Lou in Sacramento, Boogie, and that horrible Elk impersonation. Outro, Romy.
Come on.
Come on.
Good job, Matt. He called in to wear it. Come on.
Come on.
Unannounced. We didn't set it up. Elk, mate, what's going on? Good morning. Congratulations, Elk.
Jim, mate, how you doing?
Doing great, Elk. What's up?
Oh, it's a lovely, lovely day here. I was just talking to my my bro, Lou in Sacramento, and a lot of happy Giants fans there in Northern California. He wanted me to talk about Cousins. I said, no, mate, have another take, mate. Jesus, cut that crap out. You know, I like my bourbon. I was just hanging out at the bar, checking out the muff, and enjoying the game last night with the blue hat-wearing trolley avoiders. That you garbage guy, he really is garbage, isn't he? That Kershaw chappy comes...
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Eddie Olczyk is my guest. Edzo, it is so good to have you on. Ed, how are you?
Hey, Jim. Nice to be with you, pal. Always great to talk to you.
Eddie, it's really good to talk to you. We got lots to talk about, but I want to start first with you and how you're doing. Back in August, you announced that you had been diagnosed with colon cancer. Ed, when you first heard that and you first received that diagnosis, it's such a terrifying thing to hear. What went through your mind and what was your reaction?
August the 4th at 7:07 p.m., I saw the house phone ringing, and I saw that it was the doctor's office, and I knew, Jim, that it wasn't good. And it took me a while to answer that phone, knowing that I just come off a 5.5-hour surgery, having 14 inches of my colon taken out and a tumor the size of my fist, and not knowing what the growth was. But I just had that feeling, and everything just stops you dead in your tracks. And it took me a while to answer that phone because I just knew that I was going to hear cancer and treatment and chemotherapy. And all I needed here on the other end is that, Edzo, I'm here to cure you, not treat you. And that's what I needed to hear, Jim. And I know that there are a lot of people out there, and I pray for them. There's millions and millions of people that have to deal with different types of cancer and are much worse off than Eddie Olczyk. But I want to be an inspiration to one person, whether somebody gets a colonoscopy maybe way earlier than maybe they think, if they feel something in their body, if they don't feel well, it's okay to say something. It's okay to go see your doctor. Because for me, learning about this, Jim, is that I had this poison in me for 10 years. I had no idea. And next thing you know, I'm backed up. I couldn't go to the bathroom. I had this pain. It went away. I was fine. I was exercising. And all of a sudden, 3 days later, I'm horizontal, having a 5.5-hour surgery and pretty much having my life come to a complete halt. And, I mean, I was scared. I'm still scared. I think that's okay. But I'm going to beat this thing. I don't want to let anybody down. And I want to try to be an inspiration for one person somewhere the rest of my life. And I'm trading in 6 months of hell. And if anybody that's been around cancer or chemotherapy, they know what I'm talking about. I'm trying to trade in 6 months for 50 years. And if that indeed is the case, then it is well worth going through the hell right now. And I'm 4 treatments in. I have my 5th treatment on Monday, and I'll have 7 to go. And I'm hopeful and I get the big thumbs up sometime in the middle of February, and I can get back to doing what I love to do. But I'd like to thank everybody, Jim, not only in the hockey world, but the horse racing community and all the great fans of different sports that have reached out for me and my family. It means a boatload. I'd like to repay everybody and thank everybody. I know that's not possible, but I just want everybody to know that I am forever grateful for all the people reaching out, because it means a lot. And I've been to some dark places here the last couple of months, but all those texts and emails and phone calls and shout-outs really mean a lot. So I thank everybody from the bottom of my heart.
Edzo, you are the best. Eddie Olczyk joining us. You're absolutely the best. And I wonder, and you touched on this, that, I mean, there have been so many people that are pulling so hard for you. There's so many people that love you so much. We can run down the list of people. The Blackhawks organization, teams like Columbus were reaching out as well.
Yeah.
Early last month, you were actually put up on the big screen at the United Center, and the crowd started chanting, Eddie, Eddie. What was that moment like for you?
Tugging at the heartstrings, Jim. You know, like, my whole life, Jim, growing up in Chicago, and again, I grew up, you know, I'm born in 66. All I ever want to do is be a hockey player, you know, and play in the National Hockey League. I didn't know how you got to the league. I didn't know how you got drafted. I didn't know any of that. But I always had people tell me back in the mid-70s, you know, you'll never make it because, A, you're from Chicago, because there are not a lot of NHL players from Chicago, and you're American. Not a lot of American-born players that make it to the National Hockey League. It's all Canadians. So I had people tell me I'd never make it. I tried out for the 1984 U.S. Olympic hockey team when I was 16 years old, and everybody told me, you'll never make it. You're too young. You're only 16. The team in 80 won the Miracle on Ice. You know, they're looking for older guys. Somehow I made it. I made it to the National Hockey League. I had people tell me that I would eat my way out of the National Hockey League. What's wrong with a hungry hockey player, Jim, right? What's wrong with a hungry hockey player?
Right.
And somehow I lasted 16 years in the league. Was a very small part of a team that won the Stanley Cup with the New York Rangers in 94. I played 1,000 games. People told me I could never be the first ever American board lead hockey analyst over the national TV airwaves here in the United States. It's always been a Canadian. But somehow I was able to achieve those things. I didn't make it in spite of people. I had a drive, and I wanted to be that guy. And had all those people saying that I wouldn't. And for the first time in my life, Jim, when I was diagnosed with this horrible disease, besides some, you know, people in social media, I have not had one person tell me I wasn't going to win, I wasn't going to beat this. And you think about life and life circle, like to have all those things happen to me over my lifetime and achieve those goals just because I was lucky enough and was given a gift. But now all of a sudden I'm going through this battle and I have everybody pulling for me, and it means the world to me and my family.
Eddie Olczyk joining us. You know, Ed, there's so many people going through similar battles. I know you know that to be true because you're hearing from these people. And maybe there's some others who didn't know that you were dealing with this, but they're hearing it and they're inspired and they're motivated. There's one more thing that I want you to address. You were asked a while back that if you were wrestling a grizzly bear, would you stop wrestling when you're tired or when it's tired? What did you make of that question, Ed, at that time? And how is that kind of informing the way that you're approaching this whole process now?
Well, I was a hockey player, and I had a coach ask me that question when things were tough. And at first, I was taken back by it, Jim, because first off, I mean, who in hell thinks about wrestling a gorilla or a grizzly bear, right?
Right.
But when you really think about it, it's like, well, if I did, of course I'm not going to stop until the gorilla or grizzly bear is tired. I mean, that's just the reality of it. And maybe the life lesson wasn't at that particular time, 14 years into my National Hockey League career. My old coach, Lauren Mollican, who was my coach for the Chicago Blackhawks and who I eventually hired to be my assistant, Jim, my first assistant when I was coaching the Pittsburgh Penguins back some, 11 or 12 years ago. All of a sudden, that came back to me when I was diagnosed with this horrible disease. And I know what my grizzly bear is in this, and I am not going to stop until it's completely out of me and I get the thumbs up that I'm completely healthy.
Eddie Olczyk joining us. All right, Ed, so before you go, let's talk some horse racing. The Breeders' Cup, which I know you love, starts tomorrow, and there's no way that I let you go without talking about that and a little bit of hockey. Let's talk ponies. When you look at the Breeders' Cup Classic, this is one of the deepest and best races that you'll see. I know you're a huge fan of Arrogate and have been for a long time. How do you like Del Mar as a track for him?
Well, after the last two races, even though his last one was a much better race than the prior, and I think that there's no doubt that the trip over to Dubai did a lot of – it took a lot out of him. If this race was not at Del Mar, he would be my pick. I'm just a little concerned being on the inside, not taking to the track, so to speak. It's like players, it's like teams. It doesn't matter what you're doing, you just don't have it at that particular place. And I know he's won over the Del Mar track. Now, Jim, you know this because you race horses there. Is the track going to be any different than it was 2 or 3 months ago? The weather, the climate, the moon, you know, all that kind of, the marine layer, all that thing plays into it. But for me, and for as much as I love Arrogate, as you mentioned, look at, and Bob Baffert and his wife Jill and Bodie have been overly incredible in supporting me and checking on me over and over again. But you know, it is horse racing, it is gambling, it is wagering. When I get my feet wet, I'm going to use them, but I can't use them in my top two. So look, if you can throw out one of the top favorites, and he's going to be second choice behind Gunrunner, I just think that sometimes maybe lose a little off the fastball, and I can't say that he likes Del Mar anymore because of the two races that he ran, even though his last race was pretty special. I just think he's up against it in the Breeders' Cup Classic.
Eddie, what about Gunrunner? I love Gunrunner. He is a beast.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big candy ride guy. In fact, the owner of Gunrunner, Ron Winchell, is a partner of ours in another horse. I mean, I know he's in tough, but I love Gunrunner. How do you feel about his chances?
No, yeah, that's my pick, Jim. I love five. I love the 11 collected. The other Bob Baffert, you know, I mean, how good is Bob Baffert? He's got four in the Breeders' Cup Classic. So, to me, I think it's a 5-11, 11-5. Like, I'm going to go with Gunrunner on top. I agree with you. I think this horse has gotten so much better with age. I think tactical now. I think collected is going to get out there. West Coast going to put a little pressure. But I think Gunrunner is going to be sitting no worse than third. Sit the trip. A little bit of a shorter turn at Del Mar. Get the quick run. But I agree with you. Like, he's going to be the favorite. There's no doubt. But I think that this, the improving horse, seems to get over Del Mar, at least to this point. I never raced there, but training over it extremely well. I'm not a chalk player, as you know, Jim. I don't mind taking the shot every once in a while at 8-10-1. But to me, I just think that it's time for Gunrunner to get the accolades that he deserves. But I think it's going to be a heck of a race. So I'm going to just try to play an ice cold 5-11-1 Gunrunner over collected over Arrogate. And we'll see if we can maybe turn a smaller paying try into something pretty good if you go deep enough to the windows.
That's good enough for me. Ed, before you go, it's such a great weekend of racing. There's so many other opportunities, so many great races and great horses. Anything else catch your eye, be it the Turf Sprint, the Juvenile Fillies, anything that you really like especially?
Yeah, I think there's two races. The Turf Sprint, Lady Aurelia, I think, you know, the Del Mar Turf Course at 5 furlongs. You think it would favorite speed a little bit, but it really isn't. I think there's going to be enough horses there to put a little pressure there. I think Lady Aurelia Philly will be able to sit there. That's the three horse in that race. And then I think there's a turf. I think it's a juvenile turf. I think you got to take a look at a horse named Snapper Sinclair. I think that this horse is sitting on a monster race. Not a great post position on the outside, but I think you're going to get all of at least 12 to 15 to 1. And I think you go across the board, you're going to make some money. So those are two horses that stick out for Eddie Olczyk. And yes, the bankroll will be a little bit lighter, but hopefully it'll be way bigger, Jim, after I go to the windows, and hopefully those horses can cross the wire first.
Jim Kelly joining us. All right, so before we talk about Jim Kelly of Football Life, I've got to ask you about the Buffalo Bills. Jim, before the start of the season, it seemed like the team made a number of moves that had people thinking that the plan was to tank. Instead, they're 5-2. They just acquired Kelvin Benjamin. How are you feeling about your Buffalo Bills right now?
You know what? I felt good about them early on also. I knew we had a good football team, but, you know, just like a lot of people, the question marks are out there. When you get a new head football coach, you know, you're going to have to totally redo everything, new system, blah, blah, blah. And I knew we had quality. It was just a matter of, you know, how long it's going to take. And now some of the moves that they made, I get some of them without a doubt. I think anybody that's close to the organization, understand some of the things they did. And I'm excited right now. I think all Buffalo's excited. I know that locker room is. I think they're starting to believe in themselves, which is something I think that in the past, we as fans, we as former players, always said, okay, what's going to happen? Even on a big play, and all of a sudden, first thing you do is look back, okay, you know there's going to be a penalty flag. And now we don't have those. The quality is definitely there, and I think they're starting to believe in each other.
Jim Kelly joining us. I'm glad you brought that up, Jim, because in the past, there were some penalties that, frankly, were just not that smart. So how much has changed for that team in just bringing in a more disciplined approach to the game and building self-belief within that team? And then how much credit does Sean McDermott get for all that?
I would give him probably majority of it because the first time I met him, I knew this was a coach we probably would need to have here. Wasn't 100% sure because I didn't know a lot about him. But talking with his former coach, the head coach at the Carolina Panthers, he told me, he said, I really think he's got a keeper here. He said, I was just surprised that he wasn't gone sooner, he said, because he knew what he had there, and I'm sure he misses him. But the bottom line is, when he came in here, he sat down, he had dinner, he wanted to sit down with me, Thurman, Bruce, Andre, Steve Tasker, Cornelius Bennett, and a bunch of us. He took us to dinner, and he wanted to know how we did it. How were we able to continue to come back, even after hard defeats, but kept it, you know, kept fighting back. And I said, well, number one was discipline, Coach Levy. We all had egos, Jim. You know that back in the day, did Buffalo Bills. We had some egos, but so did a lot of other teams. But the thing is, we hung together. We held each other accountable. And if somebody screwed up, he would hear from four or five other guys. So I think he deserves a lot of credit. Brandon Bean, for some of the moves that he has made, has definitely opened a lot of people's eyes. Some people at the beginning, when you get rid of your top receiver, like, wow. But, you know, he was hurt all the time, even though I thought Sammy Watkins is a very good receiver, but just couldn't keep him healthy. And then, you know, with Marcell Dareus, them, you know, letting him go and trading him, I think all the things they've done have been the right move, and it's really for the future. And I think that future, even you fast forward to what we did, you know, we got Matthews and we just got Benjamin now. I think that is for now. We have a good enough football team. As you saw, we're 5-2. November is going to be a tough. I think we only have really one game that, you know, if you really looked at it, it's a slam dunk. But other than that, our schedule is pretty tough, and we'll see what happens. But the whole team got the city all pumped up again.
Hall of Famer Jim Kelly joining us. All right, in addition to all of that, and I do want to pick up on some of that, Jim, you are the subject of Jim Kelly, A Football Life. It features interviews with you, your family, and some of the teammates that you mentioned. I'm curious, what was it like to go through that process and then to see the end result?
You know what? All the things you reminisce about the good old days, you know, you feel it in your stomach when you know you didn't win any of those Super Bowls, but to realize how we accomplished it as a team and really start not from the beginning. The only negative part I have, the whole thing, I thought 99.9% was good. They didn't have anything about my high school football coach, and he probably was the catalyst behind me getting to where I'm at. The work ethic that he instilled in me, even though I knew that I had the ability, he always told me, there's going to be a lot of other people. You know, your jersey's retired, but so is theirs. And the thing is, he said, what's going to separate you? How much are you willing to sacrifice? How much are you going to put in that effort to be better than those guys? And he always was there for me from start to finish. As a matter of fact, he's with me here at my lodge. I got a bunch of buddies here for deer camp, archery, and he's here. I've taken him to 29 Super Bowls. So that's the only bad thing I can see of it, is that my high school football coach was not a big part of it, which I deserve. I mean, he deserves a lot of the credit.
Jim Kelly, my guest. Jim, we're talking about Terry Henry. And he was your coach at East Brady High School. And as you mentioned, look, I know for a fact you're very, very close to your family, to your brothers. You've taken your brothers, but also your coach, to nearly 30 trips to the Super Bowl, as you mentioned. So I know what he means to you. How did he help you maximize? In other words, did he see things in you that maybe you didn't see in yourself? Or did he help you maximize those attributes that you knew you already had? Why was he so valuable to you?
Well, he told me the things that I probably took for granted, like, you know, where I came from, a little small town. We didn't play against the biggest schools, and, yeah, I was one of the best. But the thing is, once I moved from that level to the next level, I had to get better. I couldn't be satisfied with what I had. He said, you need to work on your footwork. You need to be quicker. He said, your release, you need to do this, you need to do that. But it's not just Terry, which was a big part, but after I left, I had three older brothers who were there from start to finish for me, and then, of course, my two little brothers. So the team effort all started back in East Brady, but I always was blessed, Jim, to have a very, very heart-wrenching family that always was there for me. Not one time they were ever jealous of what I've done or what I had. I've always tried to share everything with Mom and Dad and my five brothers, and now I got two beautiful girls and a beautiful wife, and I'm happy, and, you know, the thing is, you know, going through so many ups and downs in my life, which you'll see when Football Life airs tomorrow night, that, you know, it's all about the attitude that you have, and I've been very blessed to have great people around me, not just my family, but guys you'll hear them, Frank Reich, Steve Tasker, Thurman Thomas, all these guys that were a big part of that Football Life, but also and continue to be a big part of my life now. So they would never let me slide or slip. They're always there to help me, pick me up. But that's what it's all about, having great people around you. Surround yourself with quality people.
Jim Kelly joining us, and that show airs tomorrow night on NFL Network. Jim, you mentioned some of your teammates. What's it like when you guys all get together now, and how tight are those bonds?
Well, we have always been very tight. I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, we were so successful. We never gave up. We relied on each other to work out, to do all those things. And to be honest with you, Jim, as I look back on those days, going to four Super Bowls, and I always knew that guys, you know, Thurman and Bruce and Kent and Will and all those guys would work their tails off physically. But you know what? After going to 2 and 3 Super Bowls and not winning, the negativity that you hear when you are out in the public, I wasn't 100% sure how those guys would take that, because you know what? It hurts. But after I realized, you know what? The resiliency our team has, the head coach and Marv Levy, who would never let us doubt each other one bit, I knew in my heart we had the right gang. And I'll tell you what, we still get together. As a matter of fact, last year, about 7 or 8 of us and our wives went to Napa Valley. We spent a week there, had fun. And, you know, of course, every time they come to my golf tournament, I think I've had it for 32 years, they all come every single year. And as a matter of fact, we just planned another trip to Napa Valley for next year. So we're very close, and without a doubt, that's one of the reasons we were so successful, because of the family atmosphere that we had in that locker room.
Jim, my wife and I were married in Napa, so I know exactly what you're talking about. I love Napa. Napa's a great spot for everybody to get together. It's a great spot. You know, it's so amazing, Jim. You have this great, great love affair with the city of Buffalo, but initially, maybe you weren't so sure if you wanted to be a Buffalo Bill, but you've made the point that it was the best thing or best decision you made in your career. Why was that experience so special for you?
Well, that's funny that you bring that up. That was the other little part of the documentary that they did on me, because one of the things I told them, I said, make sure you put in there one of the best decisions I ever made in my career was becoming a Buffalo Bill. And unfortunately, they couldn't find somewhere to put that. But there was a lot of negativity early on. You know, I went to Miami of Florida to get out of the cold weather, and here I was drafted by the Buffalo Bills, and I wound up going to Houston, the USFL, for a couple of years, and then I became a Buffalo Bill in 1986, which, as I said before, one of the best decisions I ever made, because I am still there over 30 years ago. I'm still in Buffalo. I love it here. I love the people. The Pegulas have turned this thing around. They're starting to really have people believe in some of the decisions that they make. And they're also the owners of the Buffalo Sabres. So I love it in Buffalo. I really do. People sometimes say, Buffalo, the snow. Well, so does New England get the snow. So does New York City get the snow. Everybody gets snow. Might be a little bit colder here, but the country is so beautiful. So I'm proud to say I'm a Buffalo Bill now and always will be. And I will be till the day I die.
Jim Kelly joining us. Jim, one last thought, and you've always made the point that when you travel around and you spend time with people who are going through tough times, you're reminded that you don't have it so bad, and it's an amazing attitude to have. What do you take away from that time that you spend with folks who are going through challenging times, and then what is your message to them?
I think you hit it right on, is, you know, spend that quality time, and I realize, you know what, that's what I do for a living now. I travel the country speaking. I probably speak 4 to 5 times a month, which is pretty good. Now I have some fun times with my family, but the bottom line is it's the attitude. And it's not always about the person that's going through it. It's who you surround yourself with, your caregivers, whether it's the nurses at the hospital you're in, whether it's your family, your brother, your sister, your mom, your dad. And I just try to tell people that it's not always the person going through it. You have to be able to have that right attitude around them, being able to cheer them up when they need. I said, it's not always because if they have cancer or whether they have something wrong with them. Even your grandparents, when they're having a bad day, go over there, give them a hug, tell them how much you love them. Because I knew when I was in the hospital and they gave me less than a 10% chance of living, my family not one time ever walked into my room with a frown on their face. They walked in with an attitude that they're going to make my day better by their presence, by their attitude and everything they said. And I can always remember, you know, Marina walking in, Thurman and Bruce, and of course my two daughters, when they walk in, it just brightens your day. And you know, when you're going through tough times, you need that positive attitude around you. You need that positive vibe. And that's what family and friends brought to my life. And finally, Jim, you know, I live by the 4 F's. Number one is my faith. There's no doubt that I'm still here because the good Lord said he's not finished with me yet. And the prayers out there from everybody definitely helped. Number two is my family. As I told you before, my wife, my kids, my brothers, they always had that attitude, you're going to make my day better. Number three is my buddies. Whether it was Bruce or Thurman or my buddies that went to University of Miami with me or my buddies from East Brady, they always had that smile for me. And finally, the fans. The cards, the letters I've received from people just amaze me, that Dolphin fans, Jets fans, Patriots fans, Cowboy fans, they're all saying, you know what, I used to not be a fan of yours when you played because you always used to win, but I didn't win them all. But it's trying to make that attitude and trying to change people. I come up with a saying, make a difference today for someone who's fighting for their tomorrow. And it makes so much sense because I want people out there to realize and to understand when they tell me that I inspire them never to give up, I want them to know that keeps me plugging along. That keeps me hopefully making a difference for others or, that are struggling. So I've been a very blessed man. I know I don't have as bad as a lot of other people. So I don't know what that day holds, that day that the good Lord has for me. But I'll tell you what, I'm going out with a smile on my face and I'm going down swinging. But right now, I don't think it's my time yet.
My man, Jim Kelly, coming up big. A member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And if you want more of this same message, more of the same energy and enthusiasm and charisma, you want to check out Jim Kelly, A Football Life. It premieres Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern on NFL Network. Jim, it is so good to hear your voice. It is so good to get caught up, and it's great to have you back, Jim. I'll look forward to watching that tomorrow, and always good to talk to you.
You got it, Jim, and it's always a pleasure talking with you. You're one of the best. I love listening to you. Take care of yourself. God bless you, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, so as I mentioned, I'm off tomorrow because I'm going to the Breeders' Cup. Breeders' Cup event is in Del Mar Friday and Saturday, and they've been working towards this weekend for a long, long time in Del Mar. I'm anxious to get down there, so I'm going to take tomorrow off, which means today is my Friday, and if today is Friday, that means that Alvy is going to take a look back at the week that was.
Folks, for more on what's happening around the league, let's welcome in our colleagues, Jim Rome from CBS Sports Radio.
Welcome to the jungle. My name is Jim Rome. A very good Monday to you. Coming off an insane weekend, it is good to be back. Made a road trip to New York and back. Got a lot done. Very, very productive weekend, and we've got a lot to cover today. Let's get it. Let's not waste any time.
Yeah!
We're in the air maybe 10 minutes, and I wake up, and my phone's gone. When the plane took off, I had it, and then 15 minutes later, I didn't have it. Only an idiot can lose their phone sitting in a seat on takeoff, and I did.
I don't want to hear from another imbecile. Anybody else ever lose their phone?
And the Astros win 13-12 and 10.
I have finished about two bottles of rum chata with my crew.
Doesn't make any sense. Let's get shots of rum chata.
It's happening.
You know, in a way, this is why people don't call the program. Sam in Houston forgot to tag his call.
War Lady Clones.
War Lady Clones.
We were done.
Seahawks, they played a good game. They beat us. Play football for a living.
Greg Bishop joining us. So what about when McNair met with the players on Saturday in an attempt to explain what happened?
I don't think it helped. In fact, I think it made it worse. He was sorry if he offended anyone. It was one of those non-apology apologies.
Sincerely, female body inspector, Halloween costume, and gout. Memphis quarterback Riley Ferguson, my guest.
I definitely wanted to be in school playing football, but at the end of the day, I have to eat to stay alive, and I think that was one thing that kind of opened my eyes.
We are going to be on TV.
High definition.
The Jungle finally makes it to television.
Hey, y'all, watch
We're
going to
air all 3 hours live, Monday through Friday, on CBS Sports Network starting January 2nd. Make sure you have CBS Sports Network.
He throws the opposite way. The pass is picked off.
I mean, my man was bad. If Trevor Siemian manages to somehow miraculously hit you in the hands or the chest with a pass, you better catch it. Because the way he's chucking it, you have no idea when you're going to get another shot.
It's mind-boggling.
Greg Robertson is my guest.
And so I had to make a decision, like, whether I wanted to pursue Australian rules or pursue my dream of playing in the NFL. I stuck to my guns, and here I am.
You know, time in New England was great. Thank them for everything.
So before you come in here and tell me that I got it wrong with Jimmy Garoppolo, do you know who the hell I am? I'm Bill Belichick. I'm right. You're wrong. Happy Halloween. Peace. I'm out. We're talking to Arizona head coach Rich Rodriguez. Last year when you faced Washington State, didn't go quite as well. In fact, it was kind of a rough
game. It made
me want
to puke. I had to watch that film all week last week getting ready, and I was like, gosh, I can't wait till we play. I'm sick every day.
The fans are really kooky. They'll all be kind of loopy. They love to hear Vince Paulie, the Dodgers family.
Not bad, Larry. Not bad at all. Horrible. Janet Rome's in. Some fire. Oh, my God, Jimmy. Don't read that. No, I won't. Sweetheart.
Sweetheart.
I have never seen her bring fire like that on anybody.
Dodger baseball.
Dan, please act.
The way this series has gone, to do it justice for baseball, this thing has to go 7 games.
Dodgers win 3-1.
But I got to start today again with the two best words in all of sports. Game 7. John Morosi is back.
Happy Game 7 day to you and everyone. I feel like this truly is a national holiday of ours.
The first inning is over and Morrow gets the job done.
He was phenomenal. You look at what he did last night. That, to me, was the turning point of the game.
I, Ray Craig.
I am just completely torn and frayed. I don't know if there is enough beer in the keg to get the adrenaline level down.
Oh, my God, this is
You deserve better than this, C-Town. Unfortunately, you're not going to get better than this anytime soon. The Browns are truly an embarrassment to themselves, to you, and to the entire league.
This is for you!
We are joined by Nikola Vucevic.
Now, one of the things you wanted as a birthday present was a nice painting of Darth Vader.
So I always wanted to get one because I'm a big Vader fan, and I thought it would really look cool and, you know, in my man cave.
H-Town fans, brutal. You guys are scared cowards. Thanks, Albie. It's hot bats versus tired pitching. And I guess you'd kind of give the edge to Houston on that. Shout out to Dodger fans. Talk to you later. Bye.
Come on.
Good times, right? Who doesn't love that song?
I've been listening a long time, probably 20 years, since you had the big fax.
You're talking about the huge fax, or are you talking about the big call of the day?
Big.
Jim Rome, of course, does the best sports radio show in America, 9 to noon West Coast time. He's also got a very special standalone podcast.
Obviously, Paul Barron was not happy to hear any of this, and his
This guy is such a jerk off. The biggest piece of in all of sports. Bob Arum, ladies and gentlemen.
And the Astros are two.
In fact, the Astros are the reason that game was so crappy, because they came out and they punched the Dodgers in the face and then they choked them right out. So again, before you blame anybody on LA, tip your hat to Houston.
Hey, you beat our ass. George Springer is a monster.
I want to thank our cross-state rivals, the Texas Rangers, for trading you to the Dodgers so we could kick his ass.
Elk, mate.
You know, I like my bourbon. I was just hanging out at the bar, checking out the muff.
Quote, checking out the muff. The best day of my life was when me and a few fellas from the frat house. This guy's got the answer now. Well, that's easy. Game 7, 2017 World Series. We won. I asked her to marry me, and we won. Sometimes when you're in the heat of the moment,
play the way I've always done it.
So I'm going to be in a methods class.
Validation.
Thank you, Mr. Rome. Appreciate it.
No problem, Jim. Thank you, man.
Come on.
I don't think I can do this for 3 hours. I can't.
Done.
I love listening to you. Take care of yourself. God bless.
Keep up the great work, and it's always great catching up.
Good night now!
Come on. You know how I said before Game 7, and notice I didn't say it after Game 7, but I said before Game 7, I hope this never ends. I hope that this series never ends. That's how I felt about that week that was, Alvin. I hope that never ends. I hated to hear that thing end. That was so good. Alvy's week that was. Clones, thanks so much for listening. I'm going to be at the Breeders' Cup tomorrow, but I will be back with you on Monday. Enjoy your weekend. I'm out.